Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Dans la relève, Jean-Claude Tremblay approuve Richard qui cherche mot de l'œil. La passe est ici, il est seul. Il lance.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
Je suis Helga Borisavala, Université de Brême et actuellement professeure invitée à l'Université de Montréal. J'ai un petit commentaire pour Jean Bobéroux en empruntant ces mots. Je pense qu'il est un exercice très que nous préférons tous de taper sur notre propre pays et je vais le faire dans un instant. Donc pour ce qui est de la France, on aime bien et il y a matière. À discuter de la laïcité à la française, même si des conceptions québécoises sont parfois simplistes et simplificatrices. Mais on peut évidemment constater que la laïcité telle qu'elle est présentée par la République, par les présidents de la République, j'y viens dans un instant aussi, est plutôt idéologique, c'est plutôt un grand principe, et que si on regarde la réalité, il y a plein d'entorses qui peuvent faire rire et qui peuvent prêter à la critique. Il y a non seulement toute une région française, l'Alsace, qui échappe, il y a tout ce pan de l'éducation qui échappe avec le financement des écoles catholiques privées. Tout cela, ça se peut prêter à discussion. Mais je dois vous dire qu'il y a, tout est relatif. Et que je viens d'un pays où on vous envie parfois cette laïcité, puisqu'au moins, ça permet des discussions claires. Je viens d'Allemagne où, par exemple, pour donner juste une petite précision, tout citoyen allemand doit déclarer devant l'État dans quelle religion il est, puisque l'État perçoit les taxes pour les reverser ensuite aux églises. Ça, c'est quelque chose qui échapperait à l'idée en France, mais c'est toujours le cas en Allemagne. Donc, tout est relatif et on vous l'envie. En tout cas, la clarté sur laquelle la complexité de la discussion sur la laïcité, on n'en est pas là, et pour des raisons historiques évidentes. Ce qu'on ne vous envie pas, par contre, c'est votre omniprésident. Et j'aimerais avoir un petit commentaire là-dessus, peut-être pour sa dernière sortie, à vouloir refaire le concordat, en quelque sorte. Est-ce qu'il faut lui retirer son baccalauréat qu'il a sans doute passé dans une école laïque républicaine, ou est-ce qu'il faut lui faire le cadeau d'un exemplaire de la Constitution de la 5e République? Merci.
Alors, bien sûr, moi, en fait, moi, je suis attaché à plein d'aspects de la laïcité française, j'essaye de la problématiser. Bon, quand j'ai parlé du fait que dans la laïcité française, il y avait une tension entre liberté de pensée et liberté de conscience, je suis attaché à cette tension. Et je pense que cette tension est intéressante. Et c'est pour ça que je dis, par exemple, que la laïcité ne se réduit pas à la liberté de religion. Bon. Mais en même temps, je me dis, quand la liberté de pensée supplante la liberté de conscience, on constate historiquement que ça aboutit à des catastrophes. Bon. Donc, voilà, c'est entre les désirs citoyens et puis l'affrontement des faits désagréables vus à partir d'une démarche intellectuelle, je crois que le rôle de l'intellectuel, c'est d'accepter les faits désagréables, de les affronter et donc d'aller même contre ces convictions citoyennes de départ. Bon. Donc il y a plein d'aspects. Moi, le premier article que j'ai écrit dans un journal lycéen, c'était un article violemment contre la loi Debré. pourrait le ressortir maintenant, 50 ans après, c'était un article laïque militant comme c'était pas possible. Bon, ben voilà, et puis en étudiant la chose, j'ai évolué. Donc je crois que c'est ça, notre boulot d'intellectuel, c'est affronter les faits désagréables, même par rapport à nos propres convictions. Alors, la laïcité française, avec Chirac, elle évoluait donc vers une religion civile républicaine. Et Chirac, dans son grand discours de la fin de 2003 sur la laïcité, il parle de l'école comme un sanctuaire républicain. Et je crois que là, les mots ne sont pas innocents. Le dernier numéro de l'hebdo des socialistes consacré à la laïcité titre « La laïcité, notre credo ». Bon, là aussi, les mots ne sont pas innocents. Bon, donc, il y a effectivement toute cette conception. Bon. Nicolas Sarkozy, lui, à mon avis, il essaye il veut avoir une politique de la diversité, mais il veut fonder une politique de la diversité, si vous voulez, mais alors lui, assez favorable aux religions, puisque en tout cas dans le discours qu'il a prononcé à Riyad, il parle d'un Dieu transcendant qui est au fond du cœur de chaque homme. Donc il y a une sorte de déisme, si vous voulez, qui serait inhérent à la nature humaine, bon, ce qui quand même là est contre l'égalité entre le fait de croire et de ne pas croire. Bon. Et dans son discours du Latran, il dit que les racines de la France sont essentiellement chrétiennes, qu'il faut les assumer, mais aussi les valoriser. Hein, mais aussi les valoriser. Et il termine son discours du Latran en disant aux catholiques auxquels il s'adresse, « Partout où vous agirez, je vous soutiendrai. Hein, » bon. Donc, il y a une construction à deux étages, une France diachroniquement chrétienne et aspect à valoriser dans des temps d'incertitude philosophico-idéologique, et une France synchroniquement diverse où la religion peut donner des repères, et notamment dans les domaines où l'État se désinvestit. Hein, parce que c'était l'époque aussi très libérale avant la crise où l'État se désinvestissait d'un certain nombre de domaines et comptait sur les religions, notamment pour gérer les banlieues. Quand il dit, par exemple, aux catholiques, « Partout où vous agirez, je vous soutiendrai », il y a derrière l'idée de fonder des écoles privées catholiques dans les banlieues. Bon. Et inversement, il y a l'idée aussi de négocier avec des imams la paix dans les banlieues, dans cette politique qui était, à l'époque, une politique très libérale. Bon. Bon. Donc, il y a cela. Et pour moi, il y a une sorte de boomerang entre donc deux versions de la laïcité religion civile, une version de la laïcité religion civile à tendance républicaine avec Chirac, et une version de la laïcité religion civile qui se rapproche un peu, pas complètement parce que les histoires sont très différentes, mais qui se rapproche un peu de la religion civile américaine à la Sarkozy. Bon. Et personnellement, je pense que ces deux manières de faire tournent le dos, disons, à une régulation laïque. Une régulation laïque. Donc c'est pour ça que j'ai essayé à la fois d'analyser et puis de contester ces deux visions des choses. Et j'ai commis un livre qui s'appelle « La laïcité expliquée à M. Sarkozy et à ceux qui écrivent ses discours ». Bon, parce que effectivement, en plus, les personnes qui ont écrit les discours du Latran et de Riyad sont connues et que c'est pas neutre non plus dans cette affaire.
Merci. Pour des raisons évidentes, puisque nous avons la chance d'avoir Charles Taylor et d'avoir aussi des collègues comme Jocelyn McClure ici présents avec nous, si vous souhaitez réagir ou commenter ou enfin réagir à de nombreux commentaires qui ont été suscités dans les trois présentations, évidemment, nous serions très enclins à vous entendre.
Monsieur Tassier, vous avez demandé quel est le rôle de ces commissions-là et comment est-ce qu'ils arrivent. Mais dans notre cas au Québec, il y avait une crise de la classe politique, ressentie par la classe politique à cause de ce mouvement d'opinion, un peu véhiculé aussi par les médias, mais un mouvement d'opinion très sérieux autour des accommodements raisonnables, qui risquait de rebondir dans le système politique parce qu'il y avait un parti d'opposition qui semblait vouloir charrier ça. Et là, le système politique, les classes politiques se sentaient un peu démunies. Comment réagir à ça? Le gouvernement ne voulait pas carrément suivre ce chemin-là, mais il ne savait pas que dire. Et alors, on fait appel à une commission à l'extérieur. C'est ça toute la symbologie de ça, deux intellectuels un peu déconnectés peut-être, mais quand même pas du tout engagés dans la lutte politique, afin de gagner du temps. Et c'est le rôle qu'on voit souvent attribuer à des commissions politiques. On est pris au dépourvu, mais on ne veut pas décider tout de suite. Il faut gagner du temps. Ne parlez pas de ça, je vous en prie. On va remettre ça à une commission. Maintenant, ça se joue de différentes façons. Et je crois que, par un miracle que je ne comprends pas tout à fait encore, on a réussi peut-être, la commission a réussi, ou la consultation a réussi à calmer le jeu. Et, en quelque sorte, les politiciens ne sont plus devant le problème. C'est un peu ça. Ça les a dégagés du problème qui semblait insoluble. Il a disparu sur le plan de l'opinion publique.
Est-ce que je peux vous dire, est-ce que vous êtes satisfait de ce résultat-là? Ça, c'est le seul résultat de la mission Chapter. Est-ce que vous
vous dites, mission immédiate accomplie. Vraiment, on s'en allait vers un affrontement qui aurait été très dommageable et très, très difficile pour notre société. Hein. C'est-à-dire, et qui aura alimenté une espèce de soupçon à l'égard des immigrants et un sentiment chez les immigrants, chez les gens de l'extérieur qui ne sont pas acceptés. Ça aurait été, pour nous, invivable. Alors, ça s'est arrêté, au moins ça. On aurait voulu que les causes foncières et de base auraient été examinées, qu'on a essayé d'examiner, mais qu'on a pris des mesures pour éviter ça à l'avenir. Et ça, on n'a pas réussi.
Mais c'est ce que vous diriez maintenant.
C'est ce que je dis maintenant, mais à l'époque, tous les espoirs étaient permis. Et naturellement, les commissaires, on se donne des rêves d'omnipotence, etc., passent à travers l'esprit. Maintenant, je suis satisfait que ce n'était pas un échec total. Si ça avait été exactement la même atmosphère qu'au départ, j'aurais dit on a perdu notre temps, ou pire, on craignait d'attiser le feu sans nous amener à une espèce de calme relatif. Et à certains moments de la consultation, c'était une peur réelle. On a pris une chance. C'était un pari qu'on a fait sur les mœurs démocratiques des Québécois. Et le pari a été gagné, et je suis heureux, mais on n'est pas avancé plus loin. La seule autre chose qu'on peut s'attribuer, c'est si jamais ça rebondit à l'avenir, il y aura au moins des études de fait et des propositions. Les gens peuvent enlever le rapport, poussiérer, et puis voir qu'est-ce qu'il y a là-dedans, et peut-être trouveront-ils de bonnes idées. Oui. Et il n'y a pas seulement le rapport, il y a tous les travaux qui ont été, disponibles en annexe. Il y a François Fournier qui était là tout à l'heure, il n'est plus là maintenant. Ah oui, il est là, qui a travaillé beaucoup à cet aspect du rapport. Et c'est un apport considérable pour l'avenir, si jamais on veut affronter ce problème. Le veut-on? Oui. C'est ça, de ça qu'il s'agit finalement lors de ce débat. Il y avait beaucoup de mythologie, etc. Okay. Comment éviter ça? Comment créer des rapports entre différents catégories de citoyens pour que... Alors, il y a tout un pan de recommandations. Mais il y a aussi un des problèmes les plus criants, c'est que nous traitons très mal nos immigrants, que les gens qui viennent ici avec certaines qualifications, qui sont choisis parce qu'ils sont médecins ou ingénieurs, etc., n'arrivent pas à se placer, et pour des raisons de un peu de défense, peut-être de corporation, mais beaucoup, beaucoup de manque d'organisation, de la formation d'appoint qui pourrait leur permettre de faire ça. Maintenant, le gouvernement a promis d'agir là-dessus. On attend. Mais au moins, ils ont promis d'agir là-dessus. Et puis, j'ai l'espoir que peut-être ça va arriver. Mais ça, c'est très important. Je crois que c'est un élément pour notre paix, unité future, la société québécoise, un élément absolument majeur. Et on a réussi à dramatiser ça, surtout parce qu'on a été suivi par la presse. C'est ça qui était très, très bien. On a réussi à dramatiser ça au point où tout le monde a reconnu, oui, c'est important, mais... On attend. Est-ce qu'ils vont vraiment? Oui.
My name is Jeffrey Sachs. I'm a doctoral student at McGill at the Institute of Islamic Studies. There seems to be general agreement, both within the Bouchard-Taylor Commission's report and then also amongst the panelists today, that a lot of the problems that have that people perceive to have stemmed from minorities in Canada or in Britain or in France stem from misinformation, stereotypes, confusion. And one of the best ways to combat this is to have more authoritative sources, to rely on what the actual communities in question believe or perceive themselves to be doing. I guess one of my questions would be then, how would this work in practice? What authorities would be considered authoritative when a country like Britain or France is trying to shape public policy in a way that will respect or preserve the social harmony and the cohesion of the whole, but at the same time respect the reasonable will of these minority groups. So for instance, to put this in a context, like for instance in France, during the run-up to the passage of the veil law, I know that there was an attempt by the French government to solicit the opinion or the fatwa from the Sheikh of Al-Azhar. The Al-Azhar is the university in Cairo that's often held, particularly by non-Muslims, as being somehow the authoritative center, the kind of Vatican, I guess, of Sunni Islam is the way it's often talked about. It's not really accurate, but it's certainly the way many non-Muslims perceive Al-Azhar to be. And the Al-Azhar was very accommodating, and the Sheikh issued a fatwa, very supportive. He basically said that, well, when in France, French girls should obey the laws of their country, and if that means taking off the veil, they will not be violating their religious beliefs, or they will not be somehow transgressing Islam by doing so. This is really ironic, it seems to me, because at the very moment when France is trying to develop or to inculcate a sense of French national laïc identity, they're relying on the religious loyalties of Muslims to somebody who lives in a different country, many hundreds of miles away, has no relationship to the Maghreb population from which most immigrants, or most Muslims, I should say, in France come from. So there's this really strange disconnect going on here. And if we might respond that there are better authorities that France could use. They might instead turn to the local community leaders or religious leaders and clerics within the populations in question, within the domestic constituencies of France or in Britain. But even this seems to run into trouble. For instance, in the British case, the British government has, when they're trying to decide what sort of accommodations or what sort of policies they should make, they've relied on everything from survey data of what Muslims in Britain believe to what institutional leaders are telling them to do in Britain. This just begs the question then, who decides who is Muslim in Britain and who isn't? It's a particularly fraught question in Britain because of the presence of minority Muslim populations within the larger Muslim population. I'm thinking in particular of groups like the Ahmadis, but also I know there's a large population of Barlawis. These are Pakistani, Northern Indian Muslim groups who perceive themselves to be Muslim, but the vast majority of Muslims in Britain or anywhere else don't believe they're actually Muslim. So in that kind of context, what should the policy of the British government be? Should they talk with these groups and see what they think Islam is, even though most other Muslims in Britain don't believe this is a group that should be have any place at the table when you're discussing Islam? It seems like the minute that the British government starts trying to figure out who is an authoritative source, they have to begin by delimiting and defining what is Muslim in Britain and what is not. Is that the kind of thing that we can really accommodate with when we're discussing these notions that I think you in particular, Professor Madoud, have discussed, this notion of promoting a certain kind of religious diversity towards a common good? How do we decide which sort of diverse religions are actually parts of larger groups that need to be recognized, and which ones, may perhaps the Ahmadis, are not part of the groups that we want to recognize? Thank you.
Yes, I agree. There's a number of very real practical problems. I guess kind of starting somewhere, I co-wrote a chapter with a French scholar, Riva Castellano, a few years ago, on these kinds of issues. And we managed to agree on about 90% of what we wanted to say. And then there was one very kind of important part that we just couldn't agree on. Neither of us could persuade the other of the view that we should hold in this common piece of writing. And we actually just publicly stated our disagreement. And it did seem to me that there was a kind of national disagreement between us, because her view was that she wasn't in favor of, I mean, this is her way of putting it, I wouldn't necessarily put it like that myself, she wasn't in favor of social assimilation, so that people should have the freedom to, you know, to assimilate, to not assimilate, to assimilate in bits and not in other bits, a different pace and so on. But she thought that the state was right in requiring a certain degree of institutional assimilation. And what she had in mind was, she said, look, the state has developed certain ways of dealing with, you know, with Catholics and then later with Jews and also with Protestants. So there already is a institutional architecture, and Muslims ought to fit into that. And the architecture, of course, consisted of, well, it's most easy in the case of the Catholic Church because of its hierarchical structure. So basically, but you find one person or, you know, a limited number of people to speak for everybody. And cardinals and, of course, you know, the Holy Father can do that because they have the authority. But as was implicit or explicit in some of the things you were saying, Sunni Muslims don't have that kind of authority. They're, as it were, even more Protestant than Protestants. So, you know, there aren't even the equivalent of Protestant churches. It's a bit more like, I suppose, kind of contemporary American Protestantism, in that anyone can set up shop. You know, if you set up a church and people come to you, well, then you're a pastor. And if they don't come to you, well, you're out of a job. So it's like that in Sunni Islam. You claim to be an authority. If people follow you, you are an authority. If they don't, you know, they don't. And other people who are authorities can criticize you and say you're not a proper sheikh and so on. But if you've got a following, you are. So I wanted to argue that the state is always adapting modes of representation and other kinds of institutional architecture, and this is no different. You create the forms of representation that will work in a particular circumstance with the appropriate groups and so on. And if that means that another group wants to be represented differently, you know, like the Catholic Church in the one case, Sunni Muslims in the other, well, that's fine. You find a way of working with that. And in fact, this would relate to what I was earlier saying about even-handedness. And the kind of metaphor I used in this particular case is that, you know, you recognize that there will be an asymmetrical geometry, that Muslims can't find one person or even, you know, half a dozen people who are the authority on Islam to speak to the British state. That's just not possible. Okay, so that's easier said than done. She wouldn't agree to that. She just said, no, it is the duty of Muslims to fit into existing modes of representation. We disagreed about that. But that still, of course, leaves exactly the problem that you raised. Well, who can the British government, or not just the British government, even if you like, newspapers, you know, the media, anyone who wants to be in discussion with Muslims, you know, this can include people who run hospitals, if they want to know about what's appropriate for Muslim cultural needs and so on. Who should they be speaking to, especially if Muslims disagree amongst themselves? So I do recognize that there is a genuine problem. it's not really that dissimilar from, if we just step away from religion for a minute, to how the government has to consult with different kinds of interest groups on a particular topic. You know, so if the government had a view on something to do with health and fitness or something like that, there'd be many different people speaking in different ways, prioritizing the importance of primary care as opposed to preventive medicine, alternative medicine as opposed to the importance of surgery, etc., etc. You know, and this could be within the medical profession. It certainly would be in society as a whole. And we find ways and means of speaking to those people, you know, to a diversity of people and interests, of bringing them on board. So I think that's part of how one would have to do it, not say, oh, there's a straightforward architecture, but, you know, on an issue-by-issue basis, seek those people who want to be heard or who are so obvious kind of stakeholders in relation to a particular issue. But over and above that, I do think that it would be good if there was some more stable form of representation. The government did recognize a body, half recognized, so it doesn't have quite the status of, say, the Islam Conference in Germany or the Council of French Muslims in France, but it kind of recognized a body called the Muslim Council of Britain as its interlocutor, if not as a kind of totally representative body. But the problem was, they began to have a good relationship for a few years, but the problem was that the body faithfully represented Muslim opinion to the government when they said, we are entirely against the invasion of Iraq. And the government says, we don't want to hear your views on foreign policy. We want to talk to you about domestic policy. And they said, no, this is the top issue of the day for us at the moment. This is what everybody in the community is saying. And so the government, you know, it kind of built up over time. But the issues about foreign policy and how to handle, you know, international terrorism and police and security services surveillance in the country, all those issues created a big wedge between this body, Muslim Council of Britain, and the government. And the government then looked to alternative bodies just because it wanted to find Muslims that it could say, these people agree with us. And it carried on doing that, and it hasn't found a body that has any credibility. I mean, it found a number of groups, but any significant fraction of Muslims support the bodies that they have brought in as alternatives. So we've got a little bit of a kind of almost a vacuum where the one body that could claim to be approximating to representation, but it's not wholly representative, is the one body the government says it will not speak to, and all the other bodies are ones that it favors. They don't seem to have any followers. They don't seem to have any supporters in the country. So it is obviously an unsatisfactory situation. And yet the government feels that there is an urgent need to speak to Muslims, as indeed there is. You know, the issues about terrorism for a start, but a host of other issues as well. So I'm not providing a solution. And I suppose I'd feel, well, you know, if we think about how does democratic dialogue and democratic constellations of opinion get represented and how do they speak to each other, you know, even within civil society rather than just everybody just speaking to the government, say, you know, how does democratic debate take place? It takes place in, you know, all kinds of different ways. And what I would emphasize is that the institutions of civil society, whether they be, you know, to use my previous examples, the media and newspapers or hospitals or universities, whatever they are, they should all have as part of their agenda of, you know, community relations or promoting diversity and so on, they should have as part of their agenda being in dialogue with and getting different parts of different communities involved, whether it's at a kind of governing body level or getting involved in putting on events, you know, when you decide, when the university decides what its lecture program for the year is, especially, you know, public lecture programs, outreach programs, for instance, cultural programs and so on, all those should have input from minorities as opposed to just existing committees and so on. But that doesn't solve the problem of, like, who is it you pick up the phone and say, will you come in because you are the chosen one? So I don't think there is a solution to that. So what we need to emphasize is the importance of including these new voices, but not pretending that because you've spoken to one person who says they're speaking on behalf of the community, that, you know, the community has spoken.
Jean Bobéro also wishes to respond to your question.
Très rapidement. L'appel de Nicolas Sarkozy, qui était ministre de l'Intérieur à l'époque, au doyen de l'université à Lascar, d'une part, prenait un peu l'islam comme l'Église catholique, avec une hiérarchie et une sorte de pape qui aurait été cette université, alors que au même moment, on disait qu'on construisait un islam français, on allait faire appel à un théologien musulman égyptien pour inféoder au pouvoir égyptien pour résoudre le problème. Bon, mais ceci dit, plus fondamentalement, les musulmans français étaient coincés parce que quand on a demandé à la commission Stasi, à l'UOIF, qui elle est proche des frères musulmans, hein, et pas proche évidemment du gouvernement égyptien, s'ils appliqueraient la loi, s'il y avait une loi, et bien sûr ils ont dit oui. Et ils ne pouvaient que dire oui. S'ils avaient dit qu'ils n'appliqueraient pas la loi, ils se déconsidéraient. Et du coup, les gens favorables à la loi auraient dit « la loi est d'autant plus nécessaire que… » etc. Donc forcément… Et actuellement, bien sûr, la loi est appliquée. Mais ce qu'on ne voit pas, c'est tous les aspects contre-productifs des filles qui ont été déscolarisées, des écoles musulmanes qui se créent et qui demandent un contrat. Alors moi, je ne suis pas contre la liberté de l'enseignement, mais est-ce que c'est l'objectif d'une loi qui se prétend la loi de laïcité de favoriser l'éclosion d'écoles privées musulmanes pour les jeunes filles à foulard et de filles qui arrivent à l'école, sur le pas de l'école, enlèvent leur foulard et le remettent quand elles ressortent de l'école. Et moi, j'aimerais savoir ce qui se passe dans ces têtes de ces jeunes filles qu'on force à enlever leur foulard à l'arrivée de l'école et à le remettre à la sortie de l'école. Hein ? Mais c'est une question qu'on ne se pose pas et que j'aimerais bien qu'on se pose. Quelle agressivité on crée ? Quel ressenti douloureux on crée ? Quelle contrainte de conscience on crée face à ces jeunes filles ?
Catherine Walker from Queen's University. I just have a short question. This report is on multiculturalism, and I just find it striking that this entire day has been about religion. And so I'm just wondering what it is about religion that compels us to discuss it as the major topic of multiculturalism. So how is religion different from, say, food? Or why are we talking about religion and not language? And it strikes me that the answer has been suggested here is that there's a deep sense in which the separation between church and state is not as easy as we may have been assuming. And indeed, Eleanor's presentation about the political ways in which religious meaning is articulated is, I think, very telling here, is that there's a deep sense in which religions are political, and perhaps we'd be better served to appreciate that very sort of slippery place of speaking to the political but not being political. So I just want to comment on both on the religious discussion that we've been having, but also on what that says about religion itself, and if we perhaps should be talking about multi-religion instead of multiculturalism.
It's a very good question, but it's a very hard one to answer. So I think also I could reverse your chronology in a sense and say that lots of debates around multiculturalism have in fact been for a long time about religious freedom or religion, but they were framed as culture. But you take Susan Mollerock's essay, I mean, the vast majority of her examples are about religion. So I think that the confusion is not recent. The confusion dates from before. Then why? Because I guess there is a competition of loyalties between state and church. Who owns who? Who has the right to tell me what I should do? Culture can do that, but it's much harder to define. It's much harder to see the constraint. There's no doctrine in a culture. There's no dogma. There's no church in a culture. So it's much harder to actually pinpoint the link between an individual behavior and the belonging to one culture. Whereas it seems easier to do with the religion, I guess. So it makes clearer the issue of the competition of who has the right to tell me what to do and in, you know, how I should do it, etc., etc. And I guess part of the cleavage for example, in France, there's also, and I think that's also why Islam is so present, is because there is this idea that they might have a loyalty towards a community that's outside of the national community. So here again, a fear that the nation is in danger if it has to face globalization, if it has to face European integration. Are we sure that the state can mobilize the loyalties of everybody here? And in Quebec, are we sure we can mobilize the loyalty of everybody to fight against English Canada, Anglophone Canada, and the U.S., you know, like being in a... So I guess I would say it's part of the issue. And the other issue is the border between the public and private, which is a long story of the liberal state struggle also against family. Because it's interesting that the school is always one of the points. It's also because parents have a say in the education of a child. Who has a say, the state or the... If you take the comparison between the U.S. and France, you could say that, they allow Mormons or, I don't know, to, you know, school, have their children educated in their home or whatever, but it's also about the vision of parental responsibility versus state responsibility vis-à-vis children. So it's always, I feel like, the nation-state... enterprise of mobilizing the energies and the action of its constituency in a way. And I think there's, the conflict has arisen again with religion.
Thank you. Professor Madoud?
Yes, I'd like to answer your question. I mean, Wilkim Lickham mentioned this morning how at different moments in time, different issues and different groups come to the fore, politically and in other ways come to the fore. And I think that, to be quite honest, the focus on religion, and in particular the focus on Muslims, has come very much from below, certainly in Britain, from the grassroots. Of course, not only, but I think primarily. Because if we look at the development of the whole kind of post-immigration kind of equality thinking and practice, we actually started off with a focus on race, meaning color, black and white. And we borrowed quite a lot of United States conceptual framework and their legal ideas. And when the first Race Relations Act, which was the first kind of, you know, Anti-Discrimination Act, called Race Relations Act, in the mid-1960s, was being framed, as well as the second and the third and so on. The third one was 1976. On each occasion, some people in Parliament raised the question, what about religion? Shouldn't that be included in your definition? Because they had a very broad definition of race, which included race, color, ethnicity, nationality. And they said, but you're leaving out religion. And on each occasion, the government's view was, but that's not an issue. Nobody thinks about that. There's no discrimination on the basis of religion, except in Northern Ireland, but not in the British mainland. So nobody thought it was an issue. I think that
any of the legislators then, and of course they're all alive now and, you know, they can be interviewed, none of them ever intended or expected religion to have the kind of majority-minority salience in Britain that it's come to have. So how has it come to have that? Well, of course, one can point to things like, you know, the Iranian Revolution and the resurgence of Islam as a political force and as a frightening force for the West and so on. But I think that's only a small part of the story. The biggest part of the story, as far as Britain's concerned, is because Muslims themselves started defining themselves as Muslims. And there was one or two kind of intermediate steps, because in the 60s and 70s we talked about race, and that's how, you know, non-white people often referred to themselves in terms of being black or being racial minorities, and certainly there was a lot of parallels and learning, in fact direct learning, from the civil rights movement, the African-American movement in the US. But by about the 1980s, people were talking about ethnic minorities and people being ethnic groups, because they were emphasizing cultural, regional heritages and identities like Punjabi and Gujarati, but, you know, they could be grouped together and be said they were Indians and Pakistanis and so on, rather than, you know, black, brown, white, yellow, and so on. And the single biggest movement where that began to kind of transmutate was the battle over the novel, The Satanic Verses, which was sort of 88, 89, 90, when suddenly a constituency got up and said, we are Muslims and this is offensive. And they carried on and carried on protesting, even though everybody was telling them, you're right out of order. You know, we don't ban novels in this country. You're right out of order. Anyway, what do you mean Muslims? You're black, aren't you? Or Asians? You know, and no other group stood with the Muslims. You know, no black group, no Asian group, no other group stood with Muslims. But they said, this for us is more important than all the stuff you've been talking about color racism or immigration laws or whatever. And, you know, that was the beginning, and then so much has happened since. So I would say it was very much a grassroots thing, but of course now it's become, you know, a geopolitical global issue as well. But, you know, there's something right in that it should have gone that way, insofar as not that, these were always Muslims who weren't allowed to be Muslims. So I think there's also something in that as well, but I won't press that so much as that. Surely minorities should be able to set the terms of how the world, meaning, you know, dominant groups, look at them, make policies about them, tell them what's appropriate and not. So at least I would say that there's this feature about, you know, what we used to call race relations in Britain, that the minorities have in many ways been able to set the agenda to the irritation of bureaucrats, egalitarians, feminists, social scientists, whatever, but at least the minorities have pressed their own claims for recognition within their own terms, and on the whole, they get it. They don't always get the benign policies that they want, but they at least get the identity focus that they want, even if the identity ends up being more demonized than they would have wished for. And I think that actually is a very important feature of multicultural equality politics, and that tends to explain why we've got where we are with religion having the salience that it does. And there's an article by Aristide Zolberg and a co-author, Whit Loon, which just very nicely captures this, because he's trying to explain to American readers why is it, and this was in the kind of late 1990s, so, you know, it was pre-9/11, why is it that so many people in Western Europe are talking about Muslims? And he said, well, Islam is like Spanish. You know, as Americans are obsessed about, my God, are these Hispanics going to be so numerous that certain parts of the country is going to be a Spanish majority place, and then we're going to have to learn their language to work with them. So native Europeans, white Europeans, think about Muslims and the growth of numbers of Muslims, the demands that they make in relation to religion, and also whether there'll have to be accommodation, which wouldn't come naturally to the dominant group. And just one closing sentence on that, and why I think we should keep this within a multicultural frame, and I very much agree, Will's just left, but I very much agree with a point that he made this morning. He said it's good that these religious identity claims are being kept within a broader set of identity claims and struggles, that they're not just separated off as religious claims, is because, and this happens all the time, and perhaps, you know, just how the world is. I think it happens in the Bouchard-Taylor report, it happens in our discussion today. Sometimes when we're talking about religion and religious groups and Muslims, we're talking about what do they believe, whether it's doctrine or the appropriateness of certain behaviors and the inappropriateness of others' behaviors. You know, what is halal and what is haram and so on. But other times when we talk about Muslims, we're talking about an identity group. We're talking about, are they being discriminated against in getting jobs? Not because they believe God is one rather than three, but because they're Muslims, you know, which is just like anti-Semitism. So there's a kind of anti-Muslim racism, and that has to be addressed, and that has to be addressed within the frameworks that we've already, to some extent, developed in relation to dealing with stereotyping and cultural racism and so on, though, of course, we have to always be innovative and extending and so on, and customize policies in relation to specific groups and specific problems. But I think it's very important to see the position of Muslims, both what's, you know, the problems and the ways in which they're vulnerable and stigmatized, but also in terms of solutions and accommodations in terms of multicultural equality and not just in terms of church-state issues.
Thank you very much. We'll have to call it a day, a very fruitful day at that. And let me thank your attendance, also our special guests for your participation. Let me thank also our speakers. Thank you especially for you. Thank you.